this afternoon, just sort of want to have a little fun with you about the sky and tell you a few tall true tales of the universe and some things that you can look for in the daytime as well as nighttime sky. And I just sort of have a whole list of possibilities that I just kind of brought in as a grab bag at random in my mind, and we'll sort of let it flow. I guess, first of all, does anybody have any interests, particular interests or burning questions or things they've always been wondering about? I'd like to get a sense of what you might already know or what things you might have always been wanting to know but never had a chance to talk about, pop out of the place.
Well, I know where the big dipper is, and I have a feeling there's a lot more to that than I don't know.
Oh, just about the Big Dipper?
Yeah.
Ursa Major? Well, actually, yeah.
There's other stars.
Right.
Sometimes it actually helps to draw a picture of this thing or look at it on a map on paper ahead of time so that when somebody then goes out and shows it to you at night, you'll see it a lot better. I've shown this to a few people here, but I'll draw a quick picture of it here and just give you a quick idea. Here's the Big Dipper. There's a bowl of it. And it's got these three stars here in the handle. This one, by the way, when you look at it carefully, it was even used as a test of visual acuity by the Native Americans. There's a little, another star right there. The pair is called Alcor and Mizar, and it's not a true double star. However, if you look in a telescope, this one here, the bright one, does have a little tiny companion star, which is only visible. Telescope. Now, by true double star, I mean gravitationally bound, where the two stars are going around each other. This bright one and its very faint companion are. This other one just happens to be sort of along the same line of sight. These two stars here, as you may know, are the pointer stars for finding the North Pole. You can go up here and find the North Star right there, which is the end of the handle of the Little Dipper. And if you then curve back towards the Big Dipper, you get a little chain of stars like this, and then a pair of pairs like that, the two brighter ones being these two, but these four right here make up the bowl of the Little Dipper. The thing is, the handle's curved the wrong way. It looks more like a ladle than a dipper. So when you find the North Star, that's the star that's straight overhead at the North Pole. And it's the star around which all the stars in the night sky appear to be swinging, and it's the one that stays in the same place. And it's at the end of the handle. And these are all quite faint. You need to be at a nice dark place, such as Holden, after 11 p.m. at summer solstice time. And then these two stars here are analogous to the two at the end of the Big Dipper. So, however, that's not all there is to the Big Bear. A little bear. There doesn't seem to be too much more of it, but the Big Bear is really pretty spectacular. This is just the rear haunch of the Big Bear, and then this is this long tail he's got. And then, now the thing is, when we see this tonight or whenever we do another star walk, it's going to be twisted around at a different angle. But actually, it won't be too different from the one I'm going to draw right now. Out of his rear end here, you can actually see a back leg coming down to a back claw, a pair of stars there. And then, let's see, there are a few stars here that kind of trace his back and then his head out to his nose and then under his chin and down the front of his body, and then a front leg comes down to a front claw. And so if you follow the dots, it ends up, well, I don't know, it ends up looking more like an anteater or a raccoon or something. Anyway, that's sort of the profile of, you know, the right-hand side of the bear. You can see the big old head, and front of the body, down the front leg, and back leg. So this is kind of his butt, and this is his long tail. And the bears still have long tails, like that. I think at one time they had longer tails than they do now. But anyway, make sure if you're, you know, still here next time we do the next star walk, that I point that out, because it's pretty visible now. There are certain times of year, like in the evenings in the fall, when the Big Dipper is down low on the north horizon, you're not going to see very much of this very well. It all depends on the seasons because of something else I'll tell you right now. I mean, you've heard about how we have winter constellations and summer triangle and spring constellations and all that. Anybody have any idea why that is? And, you know, there is the fact that the stars rise 4 minutes earlier every night, and they set 4 minutes earlier every night. Now why?
Why was it rotating? Tilt of the Earth?
No, not the tilt of the Earth.
So where we are in our path around the sun?
Yeah, yeah. Let's just take a look down on the solar system. We're just down in the orbit of the Earth. Here's the sun, and the Earth way out here. Tiny little thing. I don't know, in case you didn't know, by the way, you know, compared to the sun, this was part of the sun here. The Earth's about that big. It's a, quite a scale contrast. But anyway, so the Earth's going around like this, and if we're looking down on the North Pole of this Earth, of course, the pole's tilted off a little bit, but it's going around like this. And now just imagine the stars all out, you know, way out there, far, far away, all around this bourne here. Okay, well, which stars are we going to see at night when we're over here? Which direction? You know, left, right, up, or down are the stars we're going to see at night?
Right.
Yeah, because when we're on the left side of this little Earth here in this diagram, we're facing the sun, so it's daytime. So night is when we're on the right-hand side. So we're going to see those stars over there. But then when you go around the merry-go-round 6 months later, you're over here, and those are precisely the stars you aren't going to see. You're going to see these stars out here. And likewise, you know, when you're up here, you'll see those, and down here, you'll see those. And, you know, you always see some of the others that are sort of off to an angle as well. And so every night you creep a little bit farther around the sun, you can see stars a little bit sooner than you did the night before. And if you multiply 4 minutes per night by 360 days in a year, roughly, what do you get? 24 hours. After a whole year, comes right back to the same rising time. And if you know, Orion's belt rises at 10 p.m. on October 15th, well, it'll rise at 9:56 on October 16th, 9:52 the next day, 9:48 the next day. Come around full circle a whole year, it's coming back up at, whatever it was I said, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock on, 10 o'clock on October 15th the next year.
That's one of the really fun things about the winter constellations here in Holden is that Orion walks, we call it, walks from buckskin to copper, because every night he's farther across the gap between buckskin and copper, but real low on that southern horizon.
Okay. I heard you say that last night. I thought you were talking about just the nightly motion he appears to, you know, as the Earth spins on its daily rotation. I suppose Orion also appears to sort of jump from buckskin over to copper mountain, but also from night to night, I guess, at the same time each night, he's a little bit farther over. And in fact, I showed some of you the constellation Leo the Lion last week, and if we went out tonight, it would be pretty hard to see it. It's already getting down there where it's just about setting, so you might still be able to catch a glimpse of it much longer.
Where did we get all the names for these constellations, and why, like, that bear did not look like a bear?
Well, part of that was my drawing, but I tell you, that looks a lot more like a bear than some constellations look like what they're supposed to be. I guess it was just sort of creative cave people that just had a lot of time on their hands, shepherds who just sort of had to keep an eye on the sheep once in a while, and the rest of the time sort of make things up. I like to make up my own constellations. You know, there's a dump truck up there, and a toaster, and constellations from another age. So, you know, you can do whatever you want.
Well, what concerned about, isn't it that when they made the names of those constellations, they did look like that, and things have shifted? One of the Earth science books that we have to teach from says that because the kids asked that question, it says that the constellations looked more like that during the time of the Greeks when they made those constellations. But I don't understand why they would be different.
It's an interesting thought. I'm a little skeptical. I mean, it is true that over time they have changed their appearance, and that's your basic question, why is that, I guess. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that they did actually look any more like what they were named for back then than they do now. That we can actually figure out. We know the motions of the stars pretty well and could figure out what it would have looked like from Earth back then. And,
but you had never heard that.
I hadn't heard that particular claim, but in response to your question about why did they change their shape, that's because all these stars that you can see, everything you can see with the naked eye is in our galaxy, Milky Way galaxy, which is this giant, you know, pinwheel of stars that takes, you know, 100 million years to to rotate around. And the thing is, though, they aren't like just a solid stars pasted onto a board that's rotating around. That within that mass, the stars have their own little motions relative to each other. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the sun is sort of migrating off in the direction of constellation Hydra, and you know, away from some other stars. And the stars have their own motions relative to each other within this mass sweeping motion around the galaxy. And so that's what's going to cause over time. It'll take you thousands of years to really notice it very much. Some of the closer stars, they, you know, they can measure. They've measured since we've had telescopes the motion of it against the background, but it's pretty tiny. But you know, you may have seen three-dimensional representations of the Big Dipper. What those stars look. You know, when you look at the sky, it looks like all the stars are at the same distance from us, but of course they're actually at very different distances. And the stars in the Big Dipper all happen to look almost the same brightness, but they're actually, it's just an amazing coincidence. They're all at very different distances and also very different intrinsic brightnesses, but the distances and brightnesses just happen to be arranged so that they all appear at the same brightness. So when you look at it three-dimensionally and you walk around the side, you have no idea that it's the Big Dipper. It's just, mm-hmm. just every which way. So that's kind of an interesting thing.
Another question, why is it that you have the circumpolar constellations, the constellations that rotate right around the North Star.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that the North Stars, why is it that you have all these constellations rotating around the North Star? I don't understand why the North Star would be the pinpoint for everything to go around.
Well, you've probably done this when you were a kid, you know, look straight up, and then you start spinning around until everything starts swirling around. And if you're on the North Pole, the North Star will be straight overhead. And so it's easy enough to understand that on the North Pole that would happen, right? On the North Pole, that star would be straight overhead, everything else would swing around it. Now just imagine backing off a little bit around the curvature of the Earth, you know, back down to Holman Village, where now we're not standing this way, but we're tilted over about like this, and you see the North Star up there, and the Earth is still swinging around there. It's just that the whole pattern is a little bit tilted farther down in the sky. But it's still because the Earth is, you know, swinging around that axis. I should tell, how many of you have been on one of the star walks already? Okay, well great, that means this is new. Some of these things are going to be new to most of you. I'll make sure to get some new stuff for you folks. It's an interesting, it's just a coincidence that we have a North Star at all. And, you know, as you know, the Southern Hemisphere doesn't have a South Star. There's nothing above the South Pole. And we aren't going to have a North Star for very long. Not only does the Earth rotate on its axis, like a top spinning, and you know, it's going around the sun while it does that, but its axis is wobbling. Have you ever seen a top wobble? You know, while the top is rapidly whirring around the axis itself wobbles. Mm-hmm. You've all seen that, haven't you? The Earth's axis does that on a 26,000 year cycle called precession. And it just happens that right now the axis is pointed at the North Star, Polaris. And in 50 years, it'll be pointing even a little bit more towards Polaris. Polaris itself does a tiny little nightly circle. It's not quite exactly over the pole. But in 50 years, it'll be as close as it's going to get. And then after that, we'll be getting farther and farther away. And in 10,000 years, some star in the constellation Draco the Dragon is going to be the best thing we have for a North Star. The best one of all is going to be Polaris, though there won't be any others that get quite that close. And I'm not sure what the situation is in the Southern Hemisphere. There's probably a few stars down there that are up to be South Stars at some point.
Joe, are there fewer stars that are visible in the Southern Hemisphere? Or is that just... It seemed to be a much more boring sky to me. I mean, this is the one time I was there that didn't seem to have nearly the kind of...
Boy, I envy you, because I've never been down south of 20 degrees north yet. Mm-hmm.
Well, they were very proud to show me the Southern Cross, and I just, you know, compared to things like the Big Dipper and some of the other ones here, maybe that's just my northern bias. But
I think there are actually more stars visible down there. It's just that there are less really bright ones and less spectacular constellations of bright ones, like Orion. There are the Magellanic Clouds down there, named after Magellan, the explorer. There are a couple of big fuzzy patches of white, which are actually kind of a distant part of our own Milky Way galaxy, sort of way out at the end of one of those spiral arms and stars in our galaxy. There are these sort of sub-galaxies or satellite galaxies. You can see those from the Southern Hemisphere. And,
is there anything special about our sun, or is it just like all the other stars?
It's a real normal average star. Actually, it's kind of a dim one as stars go. Most of the stars that you see at night are pretty bright ones. At the typical distance of stars in our sky, if the sun were there, you wouldn't see it. It's actually kind of on the dim side as stars go. But it's a, you know, pretty typical star. While I've got this diagram up here, let me just tell you about one other thing that's kind of neat to know that fits in with it. So I don't have to draw this again. Have y'all ever noticed that meteor shooting stars seem to come at particular times of year? I mean, you probably know about the one in August, but everybody's favorite, August 11th and 12th, to be exact. That's the best night every year. And my favorite is the one that comes in December. That's around between December 10th and 15th, and those 5 days or so. Actually, the one in August also goes over a span of a week or two, but it just peaks on this one night. And the reason for that is that when we have a meteor shower, the Earth is sweeping through, you know, the Earth is crossing the orbit of some old comet. And, you know, the Earth's orbit's roughly circular, or not quite, it's actually elliptical, but, you know, the comet's orbits, you know, come in really long ellipses, and they're out of the plane of the rest of the solar system, and they can go either way around the sun. They don't have to go the same way around as the planets do. Anyway, at certain times of the year, the Earth's orbit will cross the orbit of a comet, which left all this stuff in its wake. And that stuff is the things that become the meteors that come sparking into our atmosphere. When you see a shooting star, it's about 60 miles up, and it's probably about the size of a kernel of corn, typically the ones that you see that last for 2 or 3 seconds. It just vaporizes with the friction of, you know, the reentry heat coming into the Earth's atmosphere, you know, 20 times the speed of sound. When the Earth is hurtling around the sun right now, 23 miles a second, so it runs into this stuff, and of course this stuff has its own motion, and you know, so you get a pretty fast relative motion there, and stuff burns up. Every now and then there's a big enough one that makes a crater like the meteor crater in Arizona, a mile-wide crater. That thing might have been bigger than a Greyhound bus by the time it hit the ground. It was probably a lot bigger before that. But so the reason why they come at particular times of year is because there are these various orbits that are, you know, being crossed at different times of year. And also, unfortunately, the meteor showers seem to be best after midnight. I mean, you can see them any time of night, especially the one in December, which is one of the reasons why it's my favorite. Because that comet's actually going around a different way from the typical one, so its particles are moving in such a way that you can see them all night. But the reason why usually they're best after midnight is because, using this diagram here of the Earth's motion around the sun, our rotation, if you look down the North Pole, is counterclockwise, so we're rotating around this way, sort of right to left on that arrow there. So what time, well, here we are at night on the right-hand side. Down at the bottom, we're at what time? Sunset, right? Anybody that's standing down there at the bottom, they're just seeing the sun disappear over the horizon. Midnight, you're kind of directly away from the sun, far over to the right. And then, really, we're on sort of the windshield of the Earth. You know, the front face of the Earth, the side that's facing into the direction of travel from midnight on to noon, when we're facing directly towards sun. But of course, after sunrise, you're not going to see the meteors because the sunlight, you know, drowns them out. So that side's irrelevant. So it's this quadrant up here, this upper right quadrant between midnight and dawn, when you're going to see the most meteors.
Is it true that that you can see them better? Like, I mean, this is odd, but when I was a kid and I used to visit my relatives in Minnesota, they like came all the time, but when I got home, which is the Northwest, I could never see them. I mean, is it just because of the clouds, or just because it's not happening, or is there a reason for that?
Well, the clouds will certainly do you in. And some nights, you know, most nights in a dark place, you'll see 10 or 20 of them if you're watching a lot, you know, if you're out sleeping out in the dark. But most of the time, you know, unless you're doing that, you're not looking up often enough to catch them. And unless it's a shower night, you know, on these meteor showers, you might see one or two a minute. It's not like they're streaming down. Sometimes it is. And it's bad luck, too. You know, I've got a lot of bad luck. I always miss the really good big meteors, and other people see them with me. And actually, I have seen a couple of them lit up on the landscape. And, well, here's an example of bad luck now. every now and then there's one of these comets that seems to have, it seems to be sort of the ghost of where the old comet was. The comet no longer is there, but you know, there's stuff scattered all along the way, but right where the comet itself actually broke up, there's quite a clump. And we cross that clump every 33 years. And this is the one which makes the November meteors, the Leonids, November 16th and 17th. And mark this date on your calendar, November 16th, 17th, 1999. That's the place to make sure you're in a clear place. Because every 33 years, back in 66, back in 33, and back in 00, they had fantastic meteor showers where they saw up to 40 shooting stars a second. You know, for several hours. And I was in Washington, D.C. at the time, and I heard that there was going to be something happening. And so I set my alarm clock, get up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I did, and it was cloudy. I said, well, I'll try one where I'll set it for 5. And started to drift back to sleep. I said, oh, I'm not going to want to get up again at 5 and have it still be cloudy and, you know, not be able to get back to sleep. So I turned it off. Anyway, I woke up at 6 or 7 after it was just getting light. And it was clear as a bell. And I got to school, and all my friends had gotten up around 5 or so. And they said, did you see those meteors? They've seen them, you know, like 10 a minute or something, you know, 10 or 20 a minute. Now, out in Arizona, they saw literally 100,000 an hour for a couple hours. And it really was like the Star Trek effect. You know, just flying into the, you know, stuff. You just look up and just feel the stuff around.
So that was just because it was clearer and there was more open space and there was nothing.
Yeah, out in Arizona. Yeah, not the city lights. Yeah. We were only in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., so half the sky was kind of lit up by all that.
So this debris from the comets is no longer going at the speed that the comet was going? It's still, it just stays in that position?
Or? Oh, no, no. See, this thing is going around. This whole thing is going around, and it is going at the same speed the comet used to go. But at the same time, we're going around. And just the way that the two orbits are sort of phase locked, yeah. Every 33 years we end up crossing this clump. Just kind of a deep mathematical.
I guess I didn't know that comets did something other than go in a straight line. I guess I assumed that comets went in a straight line.
Oh, well, no, they actually travel in big orbits that come in pretty close to the prominent ones, or the, a lot of the ones that are, yeah, you know, important to our observations, come in close to them, and they go way out there, like Halley's Comet, you know, goes out there for 80 years, and then it comes in pretty close to the sun for part of a year. Yeah.
Can you comment on the jet streams and the ozone layer, how they're all related, and why, how far away they are, and why the sunshine is getting in when it never used to?
Why the sunshine? Well, is, you mean the ultraviolet light is getting in too much?
How far away is the ozone layer, and what's it made of, and all that stuff?
Okay, I'll say a few words about that there. Are you going to be around next Monday? Because
depends on the time of day.
Yeah, well, I gave a big talk on that on Monday, and I will again next Monday. But the basic answer to where the ozone layer is, the ozone layer that we're interested in for screening out ultraviolet, is, maybe I didn't even say this last Monday, but it's up around 6 to 15 miles high. That's, and strangely enough, you know, the pressures are so much less up there, that the atmosphere is so much less dense up there, that you could, if the entire ozone layer were squeezed at, to be at atmospheric pressure at the ground, it would be 3 millimeters thick. That's all the more ozone there is up there in that, you know, 10 mile thick ozone layer is, you know, an eighth of an inch's worth of ozone. So it's a pretty fragile, precious resource we've got up there keeping out that UVB and UVC radiation from the sun. And you know, the reason why we're getting too much ultraviolet, harmful ultraviolet starting to come in probably a lot more later, is because we're losing the ozone, and that's because of these chemicals we've been putting in the atmosphere. The jet stream is a whole different thing. That's a belt of winds in the stratosphere that just blow horizontally for, you know, at great speeds, and they kind of shift north and south, and they kind of wiggle and wave around the Earth, and it all depends on the global circulation and what's happening in the overall meteorological patterns. But I'd be happy to talk to you a lot more about that ozone stuff anytime. Let's see. Well, I had a few things I was sort of planning to talk about here. Why don't I just run through my little spiel here on the our modern creation myth. It seems that some 15 or 20 billion years ago, in the beginning there was the word.
And it seems that the great spirit just up and said, let there be light. And but not only that, also give me some space. Now this wasn't just idle chatter, because things start happening in a big way. Space itself just bubbled into existence from out of the void, and it was expanding extremely rapidly, and it was filled with incredibly dense radiation, light energy that was so intense that tiny bundles or knots of the energy formed and just popped out as particles of mass. Now, you can get mass from energy, you can get energy from mass. They are basically interchangeable, equivalent, as shown by this famous formula of Einstein. And it's not very hard to understand what this formula means, really. The E is just for energy, the amount of energy. The M is for the amount of mass. And what's this? The C squared. Well, first of all, the square just means you multiply C by itself, so this means C times C. But what's C? C is the speed of light, which is a really incredible number. Light travels at 186,272 miles per second, so it could go around the world almost 8 times in a second if it traveled in circles, which it doesn't usually. But anyway, that's how fast it goes. And so, the significance of the hugeness of C squared, or even C by itself, is that all you need is a teensy-weensy little bit of mass to make a tremendous amount of energy. And so you had this really intense energy at the beginning, you know, of the creation, and mass popped out of there. And actually, you know, if you could completely convert the mass, well, yeah, so energy and mass are fundamentally the same thing, the same underlying essence. And what is that underlying essence? Well, the poet William Blake tells us that energy is eternal delight. So in today's modern age, with all the problems, it's kind of comforting to know that everything is ultimately eternal delight. But anyway, if you could completely convert the mass that's present in a sugar cube into the energy that it ultimately is, that would give you enough. That would give you enough energy to power the space shuttle into orbit. So a heck of a lot of energy in small amounts of mass. Now, one good way to achieve this kind of total conversion of mass into energy is to bring two symmetrically opposite kinds of mass together. The two kinds I'm talking about are matter and antimatter. A particle of matter, like a proton, has out there typical twin particles, antiprotons, which are the same mass and various other characteristics, but they have opposite electrical charge. As you might have learned in school, proton has what we call positive electrical charge, and antiproton has negative charge. They also have opposite spins. An electron, the very first kind of antimatter discovered, it was actually predicted before it was discovered, it's just an amazing feat of mathematical prowess, is the anti-electron, or the positron. Electrons have negative charge, they're very light in mass. Well, there's also a very similarly light in mass, exactly the same mass particle, which has a positive charge as a positron. Anyway, if you bring these things together, poof, they annihilate each other in a burst of gamma ray energy. So that way, you completely convert mass to energy. And it seems that at the beginning of the universe, this mass that popped out was almost exactly divided, partitioned into equal parts, matter and antimatter. But it wasn't quite exactly equal. There was about a one part in a billion excess of the one that we're calling matter now over antimatter. Just a slight asymmetry that, you know, the creator seemed to just throw in there just for fun to make things interesting. Well, you can imagine now what happened very soon with this all this matter and antimatter in very close contact in a still pretty small but rapidly expanding space and universe. Just about everything blew up. You know, all this matter and antimatter canceled out. But you got this little tiny one part in a billion excess left over that couldn't find anything to explode with. And that is what fills the cosmos today. All the matter, the material stuff of the universe, is this one part in a billion of leftover excess matter that you couldn't find any antimatter to explode with.
And that's the Big Bang.
Well, the energy from that tremendous explosion is indeed a Big Bang, whose echo we can still detect today as the
3-degree Kelvin cosmic background microwave radiation. And the matter is the stuff that's all around. And what happened to the matter? Well, quite quickly, I mean, it started out just as subatomic particles, and eventually as things expanded and cooled off, they began to be able to sort of stick together into protons and electrons and more subatomic particles, but more, a little more complex than the quarks that make up the protons. And eventually, as things cooled off even more, you began to get atoms, where protons and electrons got together and developed into atoms. However, the only two kinds of atoms, or the only two elements that came out of the Big Bang, were hydrogen and helium. Everything else had to wait until time and gravity came into play, and you got matter attracting matter by the force of gravity into dense condensations, big balls of fire called stars. And in the hearts of stars, thermonuclear reactions in the hearts of stars, that's where you bang lighter elements together in nuclear fusion to make heavier elements. Now, the upshot of all this is really my favorite thing to tell people. That's, you know, something to tell your friends if you don't know this already or haven't thought about it. And that means that all the atoms in your body, I mean, what do you got? You got calcium in your bones, phosphorus in your eyes, iron in your blood, oxygen. All those atoms were made in stars. They have been in stars. They were made in stars and have probably been through 3 or 4 stars in the history of their existence. They've been recycled through stars. I mean, let's just trace an atom that's in your arm right now. Well, first of all, you know, you ask yourself, why are you bigger now than you were when you were a baby? What's the answer to that one? Because you grew. Okay, yeah, but why'd you grow?
Because you ate things and it helped you grow.
There you go. You ate stuff. You are what you eat, literally. And it was what... Take this atom here. This was once a piece of broccoli, and this one, I have to admit, was once a piece of hamburger. I'm not a total vegetarian. This was part of a potato. This was part of a pancake. And anyway, okay, so where were they? Where was the piece? Let's take the broccoli. Well, let's take the cow, the hamburger. Okay, where was it? We're just going to trace the life history of this one atom back for billions of years. You know, it was in a cow. At some point before it was in the cow, though, it was in what?
Grass.
Grass, and before that?
Dirt.
Before that?
Energy.
Rocks. Yeah, dirt comes from rocks.
And also dinosaurs in between.
Well, that's even farther back. Yeah. I mean, soil, dirt comes from rocks as well as decayed organic matter, but of course the organic matter grew out of more soil, so at some point you get back to rocks. Where did the rocks come from? Yeah, now you're into the dinosaurs, I mean, before we get to where the rocks came from. But yeah, in fact, some of these atoms, a lot of the atoms in your body probably have been through dinosaurs, parts of dinosaurs, and maybe even parts of other human beings. Probably a pretty good chance that some of the atoms in your body have been other human beings who rotted and became part of the soil. But anyway, continuing on back to the rocks. Here now we're getting into cosmology and the origin of the solar system. The idea of the origin of the solar system is that it was this great nebula. With binoculars, when Orion's out, you can look at Orion's sword and you can see this beautiful fuzzy patch in a telescope. It's truly exquisite. Down in that sword, hanging down from the belt, that fuzzy patch is a big dust and gas cloud that's lit up by the light from various stars that are in and near it. And this is the birthplace of stars. This is where stars are born, from dust and gas clouds, where the dust and gas under the action of gravity starts to contract and squeeze together. And as things squeeze together and the stuff falls in, over millions of years, it takes a long time for this to happen because it's just gravity that's doing it. It takes a while. I mean, gravity is kind of a weak force, but it extends across the cosmos. Anyway, within a local dust cloud, it will pull stuff in, and as it squeezes, it gets hotter because as you compress things, they get hotter. And eventually, it gets hot enough. Well, first, it starts glowing infrared, the same way when you turn on your electric coil heater on your stove, you can feel the heat, but you can't see it yet. That's when it's emitting infrared light. An infrared camera, you can see it very well. Then it starts glowing red hot, and then you start getting thermonuclear reactions eventually, which really start turning up the heat, and then you get visible light coming out. And so, anyway, yeah, there was this big dust and gas cloud that formed the star, which is the sun, and then there were little side clumps of it, which in most cases, actually, you get another star or two out. It seems that the sun might be fairly unusual in being a single star. Actually, we're not even sure about that. They're hunting for another star out there, which might be a kind of a faint, distant companion for the sun. seems kind of crazy to say, well, surely we can see another star that's a companion to the Sun, but if it's a faint enough one out well beyond the orbit of Pluto, it may be that we just haven't detected it. It might be something that's just so dim it's almost just another planet out there and not shining really bright. But anyway, it seems that the Sun is a single star, and that's where Sol, you know, solar comes from, old Sol, S-O-L, one. And but a lot of stars are double or triple star systems, or even more. But anyway, the Sun was there, and then Jupiter almost became a companion star. It actually emits more energy than it receives from the Sun. Very, very strong radio signal from Jupiter. And but the other planets, these are all clumps of gas and dust that couldn't quite get enough, muster enough other material to get into a big enough mass to have a powerful enough inward force to fuse the atoms together in thermonuclear fusion to make visible light. But okay, so we've got the atom back that far. We've got it back to this cloud of dust and gas. Now, where before that? Where did that dust and gas come from?
An exploding star?
Yeah, a bunch of them, probably. The material that was, you know, in that cloud of dust and gas in our solar system came from a bunch of other stars somewhere out there, not, well, only a few trillions of miles away, maybe, that exploded. And their material, it just all kind of migrated together, and stuff from all different directions got together, and somehow, just at random, clumped into an area where you could get enough to... It's sort of like, you know, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, where you get a random fluctuation of material that starts to get a head start on pulling more material in, then it's on its way. And so that's what happened there. Well, anyway, so yeah, it came from other stars, and those in turn developed out of nebulae, whose material came from other stars. And so every atom in your body has probably been through this cycle several times.
Going back just a couple of steps, what do you think caused that initial energy to form into matter? What was the, you know, how did that come to be when we have this energy?
Just the energy to begin with that was real.
And how did it come to be matter?
God. I don't know.
Good answer.
Nobody knows. I mean, actually, there's a theory that's, you know, receiving some attention, that the whole universe could sort of be the back end of a black hole of another universe. In other words, our universe seems to be expanding down. At some point, it may turn around and start contracting. When all that stuff implodes, it'll, you know, just squeeze everything together into an incredible black hole, a universe-sized black hole. And when that stuff happens, it sort of turns space-time inside out, and the stuff just goes down a space-time tunnel and comes back out somewhere else in a white hole, like a big bang of another universe. So maybe our big bang was the back end of the implosion of some other universe. It could be cycles like that, but nobody really knows. I mean, there are a lot of intricate theories about all sorts of mathematics and physics about the big bang, and I can't really go into that stuff now, but basically, I guess you just chalk it all up to God. A whimsical, a quantum fluctuation.
How did you get from the development of physical matter to what we call life?
Ah, chemical matter. Well, yeah. You got the atoms, and eventually atoms got together into molecules. And that's what I was going to point out, was that the atoms in your body are the thing that is billions of years old. Not, you know, your eyeballs, not your hair, not your fingernails. These are relatively recent complex combinations of atoms, and of course your body is an extremely complex combination. But the atoms are always changing partners, like in a square dance, you know, and getting into this molecule and that molecule and coming and going. But the atoms themselves are what's billions of years old. But eventually, as things cooled off and atoms began to be able to, as they cooled off, they weren't moving around so rapidly that they couldn't get together, that they started to be able to stick together and get into various different combinations of molecules. And eventually molecules got more and more complex. You got organic material, and eventually life formed, and then once life formed, we started to get our modern atmosphere of oxygen, which owes its existence to the existence of life and the photosynthesis that it forms.
Even our own bodies in utero go through all of the evolutionary phases of mm-hmm. development. They gain things that they lose as it's developing. But
yeah.
It's interesting if you watch, you know, development of the fetus and the kinds of, you know, structures that we no longer use but we once had when we were swimming in mud.
Part of our brain is a shark brain.
which somewhere along the evolutionary line there was. Well, let's see. Gosh, we've only got about 5 minutes. Got to cover the green flash. Is there somebody in here who wanted to hear about the green flash? Okay, the green flash. Have you all heard about the green flash? I promised them I was going to tell them about this. The green flash is, there's a legend in the Isle of Man that says one who has seen the green ray will never again err in matters of the heart. And this is when the sun is just setting or just rising over the horizon, and you know, the tip, the last tip of the sun is there. You know, here's the rest of the sun down here. Just the last tip is just above the horizon. Actually, I have to tell you this, though. This is another fun little fact to tell your friends, is that when you see the sun like this, just touching the horizon, it's actually already down. It's already geometrically out of your line of sight. It's just that you're seeing the refracted image, the light that's being bent up around the horizon by the fact that the light is traveling from the vacuum of outer space into the medium of the air, of the atmosphere. That actually caused it to bend, just like some of you might have seen out here at the pool near the sauna. We stuck a stick in the water and it looked bent, even though it wasn't, because of the refraction of the light going from the air into the water. Likewise, when light travels from the vacuum of space into the air, the atmosphere bends. So, you know, here's the Earth like this, and here's sort of the atmosphere up here, and you're up here and your horizon is out here. And when the sun, down about here, say, you know, you can't see it anymore if there isn't any air. But if there is air, it's light rays. Well, it's got rays going out in every direction, okay? But the ones in particular that are coming up about like this, they'll enter the atmosphere and they'll start to curve, and they curve into your eye. And you get fooled into thinking, if you trace back out along here, you get fooled into thinking that the sun's there. Hmm. Now, this happens slightly differently for every color in the sun. You know how the different colors get bent differently by, you know, a prism in your kitchen window, and all the little rainbows it makes on the kitchen floor. That's because each color gets bent a little bit differently. So when this sun is setting, and this is a neat thing to do with colored filters, if you have a red filter and a blue filter, looking at the setting sun, you can flip back and forth and you can actually make the sun jump up and down a bit. Because there's actually a little stack of suns. There's a blue sun up here, and it's horrible drawing here. Blue sun up here, then a green sun slightly below that, yellow sun slightly below that, orange, and then the red on the bottom. Now in the middle, they all just kind of wash together into the white, you know, all the colors make white. But the top fringe is bluish green and the bottom fringe is reddish orange. So now if it gets down like this where you're cutting off everything except for that top bluish green fringe, voila, green flash. If the atmosphere is just right, you have a nice clear horizon and you know, you watch carefully. Now the thing is, it's easier to see at sunrise because at sunset, you know, you don't want to stare at the sun. You can sort of look at it and look away and kind of figure how fast it's going down and say, okay, I better look back in 5 more seconds and I might catch it. But the thing is, you've been looking at this yellow-orange sun, and the complementary afterimage color for yellow-orange is greenish-blue. So, you know, you might just be seeing an afterimage. But when you see it at sunrise, when you haven't been staring at any sun or seeing any colors, then when you see a blue-green flash at sunrise, you know it's the real thing. And that's actually the first and best one I ever saw. It was on a Thanksgiving dawn. I was up in the woods behind Santa Cruz, and the horizon was just really clear out there, and when the sun came up, it looked blue just for a split second, and then emerald.
And again, that's because of the bent, the way the rays are bent?
Yeah, it's because of the fact that the different colors get bent slightly differently. This, say, here could be the red ray, and then the blue light that you're seeing could come in like this, and it gets bent more than the red does. So you're going to see the blue coming from slightly higher. I mean, I grossly distorted it here, but the blue and purple will bend more and fool you into thinking it's a little bit higher. And so that's.
So what does it do to the sky?
Well, there, you hear a lot of stuff about how it makes the whole sky turn green. That's not it. It's just the little tip of the sun. That's enough. I don't know. Maybe sometimes it could, if there's some clouds nearby or something, might. It's hard to tell. It's really hard to photograph it. Let's see here. I got to tell you something. There's going to be an eclipse. I got to at least tell you about eclipses. There's going to be an eclipse of the sun, July 21st. It'll be total in Siberia. But if you live in Washington or Montana or any place up here in the far northwest, you'll get a pretty good look at it. will be about 70% total up here.
July 21st?
Mm-hmm. The thing is, if you're here at Holden, you've got to...
Dawn, you know?
If you're here at Holden, you got to get up on one of those tailings piles because it's going to be right near sunset. And let's see, the sun's so far north now that, gosh, where does it set? I haven't actually gone up there at sunset to see it, but it may actually go down around behind Bonanza up there or Martin's Ridge or something. I'm not sure exactly where. But anyway, watch it. It'll begin in Seattle at about 8 p.m. It'll be at its greatest extent, you know, most of the sun covered at about 8:40 in Seattle. And then it'll end at 9 because on that date the sun sets. It'll actually set eclipsed. So that'll be an interesting thing to watch for. And of course, you know what's happening during a total eclipse of the sun. The moon has gotten directly between the Earth and the sun. And it, you know, it's one of the truly amazing coincidences of nature that the moon and the sun, which are completely different sizes and completely different distances away, both appear about the same size as an aspirin held at arm's length when you look in the sky, and they can fit in front of each other. Now, here's another thing that won't last for long. Right now, they do appear as the same size, but the moon is creeping away from the Earth at about 4 inches a year. And this is partly due to the tidal interaction between the moon and the Earth. The moon slightly, you know, it causes tides in the Earth's oceans, which slosh around in friction with the land. It actually causes the Earth to rotate a little bit slower, a tiny bit slower every day. And the moon itself is creeping away. But about half of that 4 inches a year, they can't explain. It may actually be that the force of gravity itself is getting weaker by about one part in 100 billion per year, which isn't much, but would be enough to explain. And that may be because of the expansion of the universe or something. But Anyway, so, you know, in another few thousand years, the moon will be far enough away that it will never be able to completely cover the sun. And there are already times now when that's true. You get annular eclipses. See, the moon isn't always at the same distance from the Earth. It's in an elliptical orbit around the Earth. And when it's at its farthest away, it can be far enough away that it doesn't quite cover the sun. And then you get an annulus of sun around the moon. And that completely spoils it. I mean, it's still sort of interesting to go and observe, but if you get even the tiniest bit of that extremely bright sun, totally wrecks it. I mean, even if you see a 99.9% total eclipse, that's infinitely different from a total eclipse. You've got to get yourself into that path of totality, because that's when it turns nighttime in the day. You can see the planets and stars. You see a 360-degree sunset all the way around the horizon, because you're in this round, dark shadow of the moon on the Earth, and the sunlight from all out there, you know, just 60 miles away in all directions, is scattering in just as it does when the sun has just gone over the horizon. So you see an orange sunset all the way around the horizon, and you get these really freaky phenomena called shadow bands just in the last few seconds or last minute or so before totality, where the ripples in the atmosphere, the waves of air that are always up there, get sort of magnified by this final thin crescent of moon, and these shadows, these bands of shadow come racing across the mountains and the ground and buildings, and there's nothing up there, no birds, no clouds, just these really spooky shadows that really scare you to death. Anyway, so now this is the thing. Someday, you know, in a few thousand years, we'll never be able to get total eclipses again because the moon will be too far away. It'll always be an annular eclipse. Now, likewise, though, right now you get varying lengths of eclipses. There's the best one this century is going to be next July in Baja California and the Big Island of Hawaii. It'll be 7 minutes long. And that's because that'll be July 11th. However, everything's already booked up, but you can still get on a couple cruises, I can tell you. In fact, I just booked passage on a cruise now. And we'll have a couple real interesting scientists on board. A guy who's one of the leaders in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is going to be one of the main.
You mean July 91?
July 11th, 1991.
It'll be total over part of Baja?
Right over Cabo San Lucas, the southern tip of Baja, and also the Big Island of Hawaii. It'll be, you know, again, it'll be like 40 or 50% total up here, but, you know, that'll be just something that you can do these shadow holes with your hands and get a pinhole image and see it, you know, or look through a filter, but gosh, you gotta get into the path of totality. It's just an amazing, I mean, silhouetted, this frosted black silhouette of the moon with the pearly corona, the atmosphere of the sun out on the space, the streamers coming away from it. And just, it's the most awe-inspiring experience of nature I've ever had.
Joe, there's an Annie Dillard has a description of the total eclipse that was seen in Yakima in 1972 or 74.
79.
79, was it? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Washington State, yeah. I could have gone to see that, but I had a lot of work to do. It was supposed to rain. Turns out some of my friends did see it, but I'd already seen a couple of them anyway.
Bad luck.
Anyway, here's an interesting thing. The big long ones, like the one next July, are when the moon is closest to the Earth and the Earth is farthest from the sun. Does that make sense? Because then the moon's going to look big, covering a farther away small sun. So it'll be able to move as it moves across, you know, it'll be able to be in front of the sun for a longer period. And this leads to an interesting, another fun little fact to tell your friends. We are farthest from the sun on July 5th, when it's hot. And we're closest to the sun, in fact, 3 million miles closer to the sun on January 3rd. That's perihelion, closest to the sun. Now, okay, what? Does that make any sense?
In the southern hemisphere, it's reversed.
Yeah, southern hemisphere, we're, you know, they're having their summer on January 3rd. And so you'd think that their summer would really be hot because we're closest to the sun when it's summer, and their winter would really be cold because we're farthest from the sun on July 5th when they're having their winter. But the thing is, there's more water down there in the southern hemisphere, and that tends to moderate climate, so things kind of balance out pretty much. But it just goes to show you that the distance of the Earth from the sun doesn't really, isn't the cause, it's the factor in seasons. It's the tilt on the axis of the Earth. And anyway, let's see. We've got to get out of here pretty soon. Don't we? What time is it? About 5:00.
What?
I have a question, Joe. So all this talks about all these suns, and we're just kind of a normal weak one. What do you think? Are there other beings out there?
I think there have to be. It raised an interesting theological question, though, about, well, okay, Christ came to visit Earth to save mankind. Did Christ also make visits to all kinds of other intelligent civilizations that might have gotten themselves in even bigger trouble than we were? Maybe so. I just got started. We're just going to have to do this again real soon. I've got to go say something about this solidarity meal in 5 minutes. I haven't even figured out what I'm going to say yet, so I need to get up there. Come on one of the star walks and we'll talk about the whole thing.